Mrs. Deluche. But evidently it didn't get to Brother Chairman. So the subject for our study will be the Book of Esther. And we've had a sitting with our Lord in heavenly places this morning to the delight of our hearts and encouragement. And we hope that as we go on in this, we'll find further encouragement to continue in the narrow way and thankfulness that the Lord has given us the truth, and that we are enabled to see things more clearly and to rejoice in the truth now and in the certainty of it. I feel that as we study the truth and God's word and compare the scriptures one with another, that we do find a certainty about the words of truth, as stated there in the book of Proverbs, that thy trust may be in the Lord, you see. Not in any human being, a brother, a sister, or anybody, but that thy trust may be in the Lord. Have not I written unto thee excellent things in counsels of knowledge, that thou mightest know the certainty of the words of truth? You see, as Jesus said to the Samaritan woman, it wasn't a matter of guessing, or we hope so, or we think so, but rather, he says, we Jews know what we believe, for salvation is of the Jew. And we see that truth originated in that way, and the Lord sent them the oracles and his promises, and the salvation has come through the Jew. All the early church were Jews, and the privilege went to them first. And now the Lord has opened it to the Gentiles, and in these latter days, we're getting back the truths that were once given in their purity and wholesomeness to the church. And we're thankful to the Lord for it, because he promised it. In Luke 12, he said that blessed are those servants whom the Lord, when he cometh, shall find watching. Verily I say unto you, he shall come, for he shall gird himself. And that means service. And he'll come forth and make them to sit down at meat, and shall serve them. And he really has done so. More than more blessing of understanding of the word and light upon its pages than the church ever had before. And yet from the things that the church always had but didn't understand. We've always had the New Testament ever since the days of the early church. But the book of Hebrews was largely sealed, the book of Daniel, the book of Revelation. Many of the types and shadows weren't clear to us. And now in these latter days, the Lord has indeed given us a feast of fat things. As Joel put it, he's restored unto us the years, or doctrines of the years, that the locusts had eaten, the palmer worm, the caterpillar, and so forth. My great army which I sent among you, he says. The thought being that he permitted that to come in because of the carelessness and forgetfulness of the early church when they let the world come in and swamp them. So in our study of the book of Esther, let's all turn to that have your Bibles. Share them with one another where you can. And in the discussion, we'll have to bring in some history. And likewise see that the book of Esther, while it is ranked among the historical books, is not merely historical. It does give a portion of the history of the Jewish people in their captivity in the Persian period under that empire, as well as in the Babylonian, which is given by others. But it also has some admonitions for us, some well-needed lessons for us. Lessons, you see, besides having a prophetic picture. And now as we go through, as we found in the study of any of these books, there's too much in them to give just 1 hour's time and get the whole out of it. But by living and suggesting some thoughts, we can get you started in that study. That'll be a great benefit and blessing to you. Now, it starts in the beginning of it, in the days of Ahasuerus. This Ahasuerus, which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia, over 127 provinces. That in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the palace, in the third year of his reign, he made a great feast unto all the princes and servants. The power of Media, of Persia and Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces, being before him. Now, in the various historical books given about the book of Esther, that is the commentaries,
and the Bible dictionaries, there is some difference of opinion about the reigns of the kings of Persia. It's more or less in the obscurity of the past. This list that is given here is general, and it's good for a foundation. Now, the high priest that reigned, or rather served during that period, of course, the tabernacle wasn't there, and they couldn't serve as they used to, but there were high priests there, Seraiah, Josedech, Joshua, and Jehoiakim. Now, Joshua is the one mentioned in the book of Zechariah, in the third chapter. The Persian kings who reigned were first Cambyses, then Cyrus, then Darius, then Xerxes. Now, there were really more than that. There was a leader that led the Persian people in a migration that brought them into Media and Persia, and he was not listed as a king, but as a leader. The first king seems to have been a Cambyses first, and then a Cyrus, and then a Cambyses second, and then Cyrus the Great came on the scene, the one who took Babylonia and conquered all of the Babylonian kingdom and started the Medo-Persian Empire, but he didn't bring it to its full power or fruition. He conquered a great deal of the provinces. Then after him came Artaxerxes, a Darius first, and then an Artaxerxes, and there was an Artaxerxes Longimanus, so-called, and then the final one of the scene is Darius Cardamanus, which was the one that ended the Persian Empire, was conquered by Alexander. Now, the earlier migrations are placed by some in the year about 700. That may be more or less traditional. And the overthrow of the Persian Empire about 330 or 331, that's fairly well established. So the reigns of the kingdoms of Persia, you see, were somewhat in its building up before Cyrus the Great came, and then Persia became a universal empire about the year 536 before Christ. The preparation between the year 700, if there was such an early date, somewhere about that time, until 536, you see, somewhere around a period of 200 years, was the building up of the empire and its increase. Then from 536 to 331 was its universal reign until the Grecian Empire came on the scene and took its place as the universal empire. Now notice in the beginning of this, I might also add in that the royal stock of Judah, which wasn't reigning but still lived, was Jeconiah, Salathiel, Zerubbabel, and Hananiah. This Zerubbabel is the same one mentioned in Zechariah's prophecy also, the fourth chapter. Now, these, as I said about the Persian kings, you'll find a pretty good discussion of them in Fawcett's Encyclopedia, or Bible Dictionary, which is more modern than some of the other investigations. But as I say, there's a little difference of a few years. For instance, in the, well, I'll mention that later. But in the early part of our chapter, then, the third year of the reign of this Xerxes, which is here called Artaxerxes. He made this great feast, which seems to have been about the year 483 before Christ. There may be a few years leeway either way there, some put around 490, but in that year he made this great feast that's called the Great Assemblage, about that date, 483, 490, along there. Remember that the years before Christ decrease in their value, so that 700 is before 500, and 490 would be before a 483, and so on. 331 would be the end of the Persian Empire. The feast that he gives here was after the king had moved from Sardis, which had been his capital, to Susa. Susa is the ordinary name given in the histories, but it's called Shushan here. It was a city of two parts, the upper and the lower, and in it was built the palace of the king, and in it also the Persian nobles were. Now, in the first chapter is given a list that corresponds with that given in Herodotus. He says, as an ancient historian, that there were seven Persian families of nobility, and they lived in around the king's palace and were usually his counselors. They're given as his counselors in this first chapter. He mentions them in the 10th verse. It says, on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Histha, Habona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zithar, and Carcass, the seven chamberlains. Well, this chamberlain would, in our understanding now, mean a house servant, but they were really heads of noble families that were the counselors of the king, as it calls them here. They had served in the presence of Ahasuerus, the king. Now notice that in this great assembly, which was the gathering of the glory of the Persian Empire, Media and Persia brought together. You know, in Daniel it pictures the Persian Empire by a bear, and says that it was raised up on one side. And that's the way it was in history, that the Median side was the dominant one at first, but the Persian became the dominant one afterwards, and continued that way. It was raised up on the one side, the Persian side. Now, during this banquet time, it says that he gave a banquet here and a celebration for 180 days. You see, that's 6 long months of 30 days each. And it says that the king, as it were, lavished expenditure with no end upon that great feast. He said in the fifth verse there, that when these days were expired, the king made another feast unto all the people that were present in the palace, both great and small, for 7 additional days. 6 months' time in which all this glory was exhibited, and he mentions it here. He says that they were white and green and blue hangings, fastened with cords of fine linen and purple, to silver rings and pillars of marble in the palace. You can see what gorgeous arrangement that meant. Marble pillars to hold these all up, and then the silver rings that were on the pillars, and to these attached the purple cords which held up the curtains of blue and green and white. Fine linen made a beautiful arrangement here. And then the beds were of gold and of silver, and there was the pavement or flooring of red and blue and white and black marble in a kind of a mosaic. Evidently, there were the utmost of the capacity of the human skill at that time was assembled in that palace, a glorious exhibition. And then the drinking was according to the law. None did compel, for so the king had appointed to all the officers of his house, do every man according to that man's pleasure. Nobody compelled, nobody restrained, he drank as he wanted it, for the whole of those 6 months. And then beside this, it says that Vashti the queen made an additional feast for the women in the royal house which belonged to the king. So there were great, wonderful celebrations coming on. And the beauty and the glory evidently raised the pride of the king up until he felt that he was a world master. And it's evidently due to the pride engendered by this great feast and its exhibition and the drinking, that feasting that was going on at that time, that induced the king to make that expedition into Greece, to conquer it. But it was an ill-fated expedition. It is usually given in two parts, about 490 to 480 some give, or 480 and 470. There were two expeditions, and in both of them the Greeks kept the Persians out, and not only conquered them, but learned enough about Persia to have the courage later on to send the expedition of Xenophon down there, Xenophon's Anabasis and the Catabasis, where the 10,000 moved down into Persia, and learned additional features about it, so that when Alexander came, why, they swept, like as it describes in the scriptures, a goat that went so swiftly he hardly touched the ground. And Alexander's conquest was just like that. Swept like a miracle almost over the known world, and conquered it in a few short months or days. Now, going on in this, we see that the Lord stopped that kingdom in the isles of the Aegean Sea. They got no farther. They couldn't. In the battles of Salamis and Thermopylae, you remember the heroism of the Greeks there, and how many just a few were able to hold back and to destroy the whole Persian army, to conquer. Now notice what happened after all that feasting, that the natural result came. And as recorded here in the 13th verse, it says, after all that feasting, when the king was merry and mellow with the wine, that the natural result followed. And they did very foolishly. They asked the queen to come in and exhibit herself before the drunken, reveling crowd there, and she refused to do it, which was a feather in her cap. She seemed to be the only level-headed one that is left amongst them. But the banquet began then to consider that what they do about it. One translation of the matter, I think it is Moffat's rendering, says that Vashti was very beautiful to look upon, an extraordinary fine woman, and evidently had a good mind. In the historical part, the worldly history, she's probably the same as Amestris, the one that's recorded in history, who was deposed for a time, but afterwards regained the king's favor. The Bible doesn't say anything about that subsequent happening. But in the story that is given here, Vashti was the queen at the time. And there are some interesting things about that name. It seems to be derived, the Persian language is very much akin, as though it was derived somewhat from the Sanskrit. And the name Vasistha is the Sanskrit superlative of the word Vasu, meaning sweet. So that Vashti was a name meaning sweetest, and was very appropriate for a beautiful woman, especially for a queen. So you can remember that the name means the sweetest. But she was a heathen queen, you see, out beyond the covenant promised people. Now, God had no covenant with Persia. He just sent the angel Gabriel to order the things and see that God's plans were not hindered, that they were carried out, but as recorded in the book of Daniel. But Vashti herself was just a heathen or a Gentile queen. And notice the difference between the events that happened to her and the events that happened to Esther. And we can see as we look into the story, the message that is for us, that God always has an oversight over the things that are happening. As Nebuchadnezzar learned, that he is the one who is the predominant king over all the earth, and that he sets up whom he will and gives it into whose hand he will. Satan may imagine that he is running things to suit himself, but he really is only just exhibiting his satanic characteristics in a way that as the world of mankind looks back upon modern history, they will see to what diabolical and despicable conditions disobedient leads. Sometimes we have wondered why the Lord lets evil go so far and the persecution comes so terrific, almost to the point of destruction as it was under Hitler. We wonder why the Lord said, let the Jews suffer. Well, you see, this is the time of the permission of evil, and evil must be allowed to give an exhibition of itself, what it will do when it is unrestrained, and it's been doing it for the past 7,000 years. And mankind will look back with horror upon the experience that they let themselves be used in such a way and let people get into power. They will see that when mankind turned his back upon the Lord, he left himself open to the elements that were, and to the powers of the adversary, and the deception of the fallen angels, and he's been learning that he cannot cope with them, that he isn't strong enough, that those who stay with the Lord have the protection of his care, but those who abandon him and go on their own expose themselves to the machinations of the devil and all his angels, and to the forces of nature which they cannot combat. They're getting frightened now a little bit, which is a good thing. But so they met together after Vashti had refused to demean herself and exhibit, the king asked that she come before them and exhibit herself in her glory and with the crown on her head and show her beauty, and she wouldn't do it. So they got together, and they counseled with the king and discussed the matter, and the king and the council finally decided that Vashti should be deposed, and that the king arranged for a selection of maidens from all over the empire to be gotten together and brought there and put through a measure of purification and then presented to the king. Now, in those days, they're like in the present time. We have beauty parlors, you know, that are for the same thing. They're not getting them ready for the king, but in this case, they were. And a whole year of preparation was given to prepare these maidens for the king's inspection. And all the known accessories and helps to enhance the beauty of the individual was used. And that account is given us in the second chapter. But it goes on to tell how these were collected. And also in the course of the chapter tells us about Mordecai and his origin. That he was of the tribe of Benjamin and was taken captive during the reign of Jehoiakim. And that has the account that gives that is in 2 Kings 24, 8 to 16. And in the true Bible chronology would have been about 594 before Christ. That's in the 5th and 6th verses of the 2nd chapter. It points out that Esther was an orphan, that both her parents had died, perhaps killed in the captivity that had been taken there, and that Mordecai had taken her to bring her up, and had done so very faithfully. Now, Esther's first name given, Hadassah, is the Hebrew name, and it means myrtle. It's the same as the Greek word motis. And her other name, Esther, is the Persian name. And it is derived, supposedly, at least from the evidence given by the dictionaries, from the Persian or ancient Persian language, the Zend, so-called. Our letters be C-T-A-R-S, star, stare, C-T-A-R-E, rather. And in the Greek, it's aster, and in ordinary English, star. And as at that time, the planets were known and admired as stars, and the brightest one was Venus, so Venus is associated with the story of Esther in the history. Now, in the accounts given here, the each concubine, as they were made ready, were given each one seven maidens to help them and to assist in the preparations. But that Esther, when she came before the first chamberlain, or the first one who had the care of the women, needed nothing more than just her natural charms. And the general provided things for purification. She was such beauty and such grace that she immediately attracted the attention of the chief of the chamberlains, Haggai. That's given there in the 8th verse. So it came to pass when the king's commandment and his decree was heard, and many maidens were gathered unto Shushan the palace to the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was brought unto the king's house to his custody. And the maiden pleased him. You see, here is an evidence of what we learn from the book of Esther as well as the other books of the Bible, that God's watch care is over his people. Now, the Jews were a covenant people. And while these who were remaining here in Persia had not gone back with Ezra to the building of the temple, that nevertheless they were still God's covenant people. And while the Lord in the books of Numbers and Deuteronomy pointed out to them how we would have to punish them for their idolatry and for their disobedience, that nevertheless his promises were that he would not utterly destroy them. In fact, he tells us in Jeremiah and Isaiah that while he will make an end of all other nations, yet he will not make an end of the Jew, but he will always keep a remnant of them. But in many cases of history, we do find that the Lord lets the persecution and the apparent threatening destruction to go almost to the point of succeeding, and then he stops it. And that we have witnessed also at the present time. Hitler wanted to go into Palestine and had asked Rommel to go up there, and Rommel objected. He didn't like that way of doing things. And Hitler's point was to destroy the whole Jewish nation, just as Haman here tried to do the same thing. It was an exhibition that the Lord allowed to happen to show what the adversary wants to do and what the human mind will do when it serves the devil. And so in this experience, these maidens were gathered, and the Lord was already beginning to influence the minds and the conditions of things to prepare to get Esther on the throne. Why did he want her there? To save the Jews. He knew what was coming. He knew that the adversary was preparing, through Haman, to destroy the Jewish people. And quietly the Lord himself also prepared, so when things were beginning to come to a head, everything would be ready, and the deliverance of the Jew would be accomplished. Now here we can see the beginning of the Lord's work, influencing the minds of those who chose Esther so that she would get a privileged treatment. And she did. And while the others had seven maidens given to each, she had selected maidens given to her. And she needed not so much as the general run of them in order to prepare for the king. It goes on to tell us about from the 12th and 14th verses of the manner how they all came before the king. And the king's mind here again was influenced by, it might have been the angel Gabriel, whatever the Lord used. In the book of Daniel, he was the agent. But whatever the agency the Lord used, he prepared the mind of the king so that when he saw Esther, he was greatly delighted with her and so pleased with her that he made another feast. And in this feast, the king didn't get drunk. He behaved himself properly. Evidently, the influences were such as would keep him from doing that. But it goes on to tell us how that while this was going on, and Esther came before the king, and that he loved her more than all the other virgins that were there, and made her the queen, set the royal crown upon her head, and made her queen instead of Vashti. That's chapter 2:17. And then he made this great feast, and beside the feast, he gave a release, that is, a release from taxes or from service in the army, perhaps both, one or the other, and that in general throughout his empire. And then it tells in the 19th verse that there seemed to be a second gathering of another group of virgins. You know, when a thing is started, sometimes even if the king does make a selection, the chamberlains evidently went ahead with the project and had a second collection of the maidens come. And during this time when these were in preparation, Mordecai became aware of a plot against the king's life by two of his chamberlains. It gives their names here. Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door, became angry about the king and sought to lay hands to assassinate him. This was very often done amongst the Gentile kings because they didn't have a covenant relationship with the Lord. They were not sitting on the Lord's throne. They were, as it were, taking their chances with the elements and with the people and the forces that were at work upon the world. Those winds that blow upon mankind, you know, the financial, the social, the civil, the ecclesiastical, they're all blowing, forcing mankind first one way and then another. And as a result of those winds blowing upon the seas of humanity, these empires arose among the Gentiles, as the book of Daniel expresses it. Now in this 21st to the 23rd verses, we're told how this plot was discovered by Mordecai. And as loyal to the king, Mordecai reported it to the king, but he reported it through Esther, so that Esther's influence would gain with the king. He'd have be confidence in her. And likewise, when Esther reported it to the king, she reported it in the name of Mordecai, so that his position with the king would be secured. You see, the Jews work together. The Gentiles haven't learned that yet, but sometime we hope they will. So it tells us about in the third chapter how the adversary began to get ready his plan to destroy the Jews. He's tried to do it several times. He almost did it in this case. He almost did it unto Antiochus Epiphanes. Tried to do it under Nero, and in modern times, you remember the pogroms in Russia, and in Poland, and in Romania, and the Balkans against the Jews, They were very notable about the year 1900 and through that period, the later 90s, those pogroms that were trying to persecute, to destroy the Jew. And then this almost successful effort under Hitler, and it looks as though he's going to make another one. We find, as the story goes forth, that the picture given here really fits very closely to what the adversary is doing now, that he's arranging forces not only to destroy the Jew, and in Zechariah 14 the Lord points out that he's going to let him almost do it. He's going to capture Palestine and capture the city of Jerusalem, capture half the people, and to begin to loot the city. And it looked, will look as though the Jew had no hope that there would be beyond the reach of help. But then the Lord steps in and stops it, just as he did with Hitler, just as he did with Haman. Now the Jews hold that Haman was, as he is called here, an Agagite, was a descendant of the king Agag of the Amalekites. He is the last Amalekite mentioned in the Bible. And you remember that on the way to Sinai, when the Jewish people had left Egypt, and before they'd reached that, Amalek came out and tried to conquer them, tried to make their way difficult. And in that time, you find this statement recorded, that Jehovah had promised and arranged to blot Amalek out from under heaven, to destroy that people. And later on, when they entered Canaan, he used the Jewish people to do that. But remember how it is recorded in case of Agag, how King Saul refused to obey the commandment of the Lord. And instead of destroying that, he destroying the king and the people that were heathens, the King Saul decided to save the king and the best of the animals and some of the people for servants. And you remember that on account of that disobedience, the Lord rejected him from being king and his family from sitting upon the throne of Israel. The Lord wanted one who'd carry out his orders, an obedient one. Well, this book, you see, relates to us the fact in which we can gain the lesson ourselves, the church can gain the lesson from it, that any neglected evil of disobedience, or any, you might say, devoted thing held back, or any root of bitterness allowed to spring up and gain life, will rise up in later times to destroy and to make frightening difficulties for us. And so here, long centuries after Saul's disobedience, this descendant of King Ahag, Agag, rose up and with the help of Satan, almost destroyed the Jewish people. Now, as you look in the study, you'll see the pride and glory working upon an envious mind, upon a Gentile mind that was not related to the Lord, and contrasted, likewise, with another who wasn't affected by the glory that was given him and the honor that was given him, but remained humble. The contrast between Haman and Mordecai. Now, reward that, according to the Medes and Persian laws, was going to be given to Mordecai was held back. The king forgot about it for a while. But here again the Lord's work and superintendence comes in. And after Haman had been raised up, he began to be given a great deal of honor. And the king gave him the royal seal, the royal ring that had this the state seal upon it, and gave him the complete authority to execute whatever he wished. And that meant that the whole backing of the Persian Empire was behind whatever he did. The king turned the ring over to him. Well, at that time, he likewise gave an order for all the servants around to make obeisance to Haman, to recognize him. But Mordecai, a Jew, refused to do it. Now, possibly Mordecai knew who Haman was, and on that ground refused. But in the fourth verse it tells us that the people around there pressed him. Why don't you submit yourself and bow the knee? And Mordecai gave the reason that he was a Jew and could not do so. Well, they reported the matter to Haman. It seems that Haman did not notice it until it was reported to him. But when it was reported to him, Then it entered into his mind, and it was allowed to, as it were, take hold of his mind until the whole thing was an obsession to him. You remember what the Lord said to Cain? He said, as Cain was wroth, he said, if thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted? And if thou doest not well, sin croucheth at the door, and his desire shall be unto thee, but thou shalt rule over him. Now, if Cain had listened to that, he would have paid no attention to the suggestions of the adversary and been saved the crime and the punishment. And that's the way it works. If the adversary tries as a crouching lion to spring in it and take possession, to rule. But he says, our position should be to rule over him. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. The thing that we're learning, you see, in under the Lord's direction is mastery of ourselves under the Lord's guidance. And that's what the human race has lost. They're slaves to self, slaves to adversary, slaves to habit, slaves to whoever runs over them. And they like to glorify their oppressors and their saviors. They destroy and kill and then build a monument to them maybe afterwards, but a lot of good that does to the one. But by and by they're going to get straightened out. Now then, in his anger, in his wrath, he was not merely angry at Mordecai. He thought that would be a small thing. But he was so boiling over from wrath within that he wanted to destroy the whole Jewish people. And the lies he told about them to the king are just like the lies that the Samaritans told to the king about Ezra and Nehemiah and the Jews who tried to rebuild the temple. They were from the same sort. And he tried to make out to the king that because Mordecai had not submitted, that he was just one of the people that dwelt in the kingdom. And as he stated there, verse 8, chapter 3, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom, and their laws are diverse from all people, neither keep they the king's laws. Therefore it is not for the king's profit to suffer them. He pointed out, you see, that from the king's viewpoint, as Haman wanted the picture to be in the king's mind, that the Jews were a pernicious people, full of mischief and disobedience, and that it was a good thing to get rid of the whole bunch of them. So the king listened. The after effects indicate that the king wasn't wholly deceived in the matter, that he was watching Haman. But nevertheless, he gave him all these great honors. And the king took his ring from his hand, verse 10, and gave it unto Haman, the son of Amadatha, the Agagite, and the Jews' enemy. And the king also told him to go ahead with his plan of exterminating the Jews, and also that their property would belong to Haman. But Haman, in order to gain the king's assent, promised to give 10,000 talents of silver, which he was to get from the Jews, and put it into the king's treasury. Now, in that time, the historians tell us that the income of the kings was very large. This sum of 10,000 talents was a very large sum even for those days. But evidently he wished to get the king's consent by mentioning it and making the offer. Herodotus says the revenue of the Persian king at about that time was 14,560 talents of silver per year. He also records that Pythias presented Xerxes with 4 million gold darics, or $4.5 million in our money, and that a certain satrap of Babylon had a daily revenue of 2 bushels of silver. Well, you see, these were vast items of wealth and indicate the prosperity and the glory of the kingdom at that time. Well, the king gave Haman then the full liberty to go ahead. And the full power of the Median Persian kingdom was behind him. Now it tells us that they made out the law and had it written and sent with the king's messengers post haste over the king's highways and post roads, and they were written in the different languages and allowed time for them to get to all the utmost parts of the kingdom so that the message went out. In the last verse of the third chapter, the post went out being hastened by the king's commandment, and the decree was given in Shushan the palace, and the king and Haman sat down to drink. They were much pleased with what they'd done. But the city Shushan was perplexed. Now, the Persians as a people didn't hate the Jews any more than any others. They just despised all foreigners. That's been the adversary spirit that he's tried to awaken amongst all people. As I was a boy, we used to say we could lick any other nation with our hands tied behind our back. We despised others. And the thought has been to keep them separate, to fill them with suspicion and hatred one of another, so that they would be, so that the adversary would have an easier way to foment wars and slavery and evil in the world, to keep the world in subjection to his will. And furthermore, one has suggested that his purpose looked beyond that, and to so fix and crystallize hatred in their characters and makeup that even if the kingdom ever was established, they never could live together side by side. But you see, he didn't count on the image and likeness that still remains in human nature. Here we have those same peoples from all nations on the face of the earth over here in this country living side by side and working together and being good neighbors. It can be done, you see. If the evil influences that now oppress and govern the nation can be taken away, the common people would gladly have no more war and no more slaughter and no more training for war. They tried to fraternize, you know, when the First World War took place. And the first Christmas, you remember, the account said that the Germans and the Americans fraternized together and sent each other presents, and parts of their food were swapped, but the authorities stopped it. You see, as far as the common people would have gone, the war would have stopped there. The common people don't want war. They want peace and prosperity and to enjoy life. And by, they're going to get it. But that's the adversary's method, to keep the people in subjection, to hold them down by propaganda and all kinds of lies of various sorts. His kingdom is built upon lies, as the Lord said. Well, now then, when Mordecai heard this, it seemed to him to be the depths of misery. And he went forth and rent his clothes and put sackcloth and ashes and upon his head and walked in the streets. And with a great and bitter cry, it said. It reminds us of the cry mentioned in the Lamentations, the first chapter. You read that. And as Jeremiah's lamentation mentioned, he says, "Behold, all ye that pass by, was there ever sorrow like my sorrow?" And he mentions there the things that were done. But it was with a sorrow like that, and a great and bitter cry, that Mordecai went out in the streets of the city. He even came before the king's palace, but he couldn't go within, because of the laws and arrangements that no disagreeable thing was allowed to come into the presence of the king, nothing in sackcloth or mourning or anything disagreeable, because they held the king's personality and presence sacred. And likewise, because of the fact that there were always plots going around to get rid of the king. It's not only you remember how the king of Moab, Eglon, was slaughtered by an emissary that got into his chamber. So message came to Hagen, to Esther, about the condition. She didn't. She heard of Mordecai's crying and his misery, and sent word for him to quit it, and sent even clothes for him to put on to replace his rags. But he sent back word to her and told her of what the whole matter was, and urged her to bring the matter before the king. Well, here comes in something that looks as though the adversary had nailed the matter so that nothing could happen, that there was no help. Because Esther pointed out to Mordecai that she wasn't, that nobody, it was well known all over the empire, were those who knew the king at all, that the empire laws were that no one could come into the king's presence without being invited on pain of death. The king held a scepter, and that he could extend that scepter if he so willed, and had the person allow the person to come in and present his petition. But that if he didn't do so, death was the result. In all the pictures given of the Assyrian kings, there is a scepter there, a rod, that is always at hand for the king to use in such an occasion. Well, here again we see the influence of the Lord working upon the mind of the king. And in the preparation before this took place, before Esther came in, she reminded Mordecai that She wasn't privileged to come in any time she wanted to, and that she hadn't been called into the king for a month. It seems, as Herodotus presents the matter, that the wives of the king took a kind of a rotation, and as sometimes the numbers were rather large, it was a long time before one got in the second time. And that's the way the heathen things were run. So that Esther had not been called for over a month at this time. And she sent word to him that she could not go in unless she was asked for by the king. But Mordecai sent her word that the situation was desperate, that she should risk her life for the benefit of her people. And if she did not do so, then she could rest assured that God would raise up deliverance from some other channel or source, and that she would share in the troubles that came upon the Jewish people, and not to count that because she was in the palace that she would escape, because she would not. And so when that was presented in that manner, Esther said she would do what she could. And furthermore, she asked that in order to make it sure to get as much of the Lord's help as possible, they should subject themselves in sackcloth and ashes and fasting for 3 days. Here again is that three-day period come in. You'll find it occurring so often. It's interesting to look it up in the Bible and see how many occurrences of that three-day period of washing, fasting, preparation is requested before great events take place, like the events before the crossing of Jordan, the events before the making of the law, and often you'll find it throughout the Old Testament. So they were to pray and to fast and to cry mightily unto the Lord for 3 days. And then on the third day, the time was come to act. And Esther went in unto the king. And the king, I think under the Lord's direction, unconsciously to be sure, extended the scepter and invited her to come in. And so she presented her invitation. She wanted the king to come to a banquet and Haman to come with her. Now Esther was very wise. The Lord evidently granted her wisdom. She didn't present the petition immediately. Rather, she just asked the king to come to a banquet with Haman. And we can see here things working to a climax. Esther had been told not to reveal her nationality. Mordecai's nationality was known, but Esther's was not. And there was no occasion, no reason for doing so. Things were satisfactory. But now the occasion demanded action by Esther, and she came in, the king accepted her, she made the invitation. And on the seventh chapter, it tells us how the king and Haman came together. Now, previous to this, we can see the working of promotion upon the mind of Haman. He was a proud man, and a man grasping for power, and evidently was getting all that he had hoped for. But when he received this invitation from the king, you remember he went and told about the matter to his wife and to his friends. They gathered around him, told how greatly he'd been honored by the king and given the king's ring, and now that the queen herself had invited him into a private banquet with the king, how greatly he was being honored. And yet he says, in all this, in spite of all this, the thing rankles in my mind that Mordecai, a Jew, a despised Jew, will not bow the knee unto me. And so they urged him to go ahead. It says in the 13th verse that, getting ahead here. But the fifth chapter and the sixth and the seventh come in here together. I did not mention a thing in preparation to this before the banquet took place, and that was that the Lord was working upon the mind of the king and would not let him sleep. And the king, after efforts to get to sleep, gave up and wondered if he might not have just overlooked some things, some parts of his duties as rewards to those who had served him. And he asked for the records. You see, that indicated that something went on his mind, wondering if he had taken care of all of his obligations. And so in the records which they read before the king, it was recorded what Mordecai had done and how no reward had been given him. Well, you see, Mordecai didn't grumble about the matter. He didn't do anything about it, just accepted the situation. He was loyal at heart and was there for that purpose of serving the king, and he'd done his duty. But when the king heard of that. He said, has anything been done? No, nothing has been done to reward him. And then the king said, who is outside? Well, here you see the situation managed by the Lord, evidently. It brings this about that Haman, who should be waiting outside in the court that the king could use, but Haman himself. So Haman is requested by the king to come in. And the king says to him, what shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? And Haman said, why, all these honors have come to me, and the queen has honored me. Well, who could the king be thinking of but me? You see, that's the way of pride. The pride blinds the mind of the proud one so that he is not suspicious of the things that are happening. You see, an ordinary man that wasn't filled with pride or ambition would say, well, here, that's an unusual invitation. What's behind it? I'd better walk softly here so that I do not stumble. But Haman just swallowed the bait whole. He didn't do anything but gloat over the matter. And so his wife, as they were counseled together, gave him this heartless advice in the 14th chapter to go merrily into the banquet with the king, even though he had in his mind and heart to destroy with cruelty the whole Jewish people. And it was to kill, to put out of the way completely, to destroy the Jewish people. It's emphasized there very strongly. And now the first banquet comes on hand, and the two are there. And in her wisdom, guided by the Lord, Esther doesn't give the answer. The king says, what wilt thou, Queen Esther? You see, he uses terms of endearment and terms of recognition of her as the queen, that she has a right for a hearing. And so she asked him to come to another banquet. She withholds the information, but she promises to give it at the second banquet. And so this lifts up the pride of Haman. It gives the opportunity for that honor to work upon his mind and to lead him to blind, foolish actions. You see, that's what happens to pride and to ambition. It blinds the mind so that they do not walk carefully, but are blinded and go right pell-mell into destruction. And that's the way it worked here. We see the effects of honor upon a mind not related to the Lord, and contrasted with Mordecai's mind that didn't find fault even if he wasn't rewarded for his loyal deed to the king. Well, the king called in Haman and said to Haman, what shall be done? Well, Haman just thought it must be me that he's thinking of, and what would I like to have? I'd like to be honored with the greatest honor that can be bestowed upon anyone but the king. And so he suggested that he be given the king's horse and the king's apparel and the crown, and ridden through the city on the king's horse, and have one of the noble families, the son of the nobles, come and proclaim before him, thus shall the king wish to honor those who serve him. And so Haman, being there, was told, you do that now. You carry it out, and let nothing be lacking. I think the king must have been a little suspicious there, that he saw an opportunity of bringing down the pride of a prominent officer, at the same time rewarding a servant that had been loyal to him. And so the things come to a climax at the second banquet. And the second banquet comes there. Haman goes in a little fearful, a little, he's filled with pride, but he is full of the ambition there to carry out his plans and to take all the honor that he can get. But the banquet goes on, and then the king asks, what wilt thou, Queen Esther? And then she tells him. She uses the very words of the decree, to kill, to destroy, and so forth, so that the king would recognize what she was talking about and the description that is given there. It says, Esther the queen said, if I have found favor in thy sight, O king, and it pleased the king, let my life be given as my petition, and my people at thy request. She told the king she was a Jewess. That was probably new to him. But also it seems that Haman had never had an idea that the queen was a Jew, that she would be included in the decree. And it evidently amazed him and also the king. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, to perish, using the very words of the decree. But if we had been sold for bondmen and bondwomen, I'd held my tongue. We could have endured that. Although the enemy could not countervail the king's damage, that is, this great amount to be paid in the treasury of the king wouldn't really be any price to pay for the industry and the capabilities of all the Jews that are scattered throughout his kingdom. Then the king Ahasuerus answered and said to the queen, "Who is he? Where is he that durst presume in his heart so to do? Whose heart has swelled up with pride so that he would even threaten the queen?" And then he wants the answer. He's beginning to guess who it is, but she gives him the answer. This wicked Haman. And then it tells us that the king arose in banquet from the banquet of wine in his wrath, went into the palace garden. His wrath evidently took full possession of him. He was so angry about it. He went out into his garden and walked around to kind of settle in his mind what he'd better do. He saw that Haman had trapped him, that he was using the king as an agent to carry out his own personal vengeance. And he was angry, doubly angry, because he should be trapped and because one of his chief agents was so disloyal. And then it tells us that while he was away, that, you know, the habit at banquets was to recline there. And while the king was out, Haman saw that there was nothing but destruction before him. And in his despair, he threw himself upon the couch of the queen. And just at that moment, under the Lord's arrangement, the king entered with his mind weighed up. And he said, as he saw the situation, "What will he force the queen in my very presence, before my eyes?" And so he gave orders for him to be taken out and to be hanged. And they covered his head and took him out from the presence of the king. Well, before this, I'll have to stop here because there's many things to be brought in. And we'll have to let you finish the study for yourself. But we've given you an inkling of what there is in the book. And a climax comes forth in this banquet and how the Lord delivered the Jew, as he always has promised, and as he will even in this last destruction that is to be planned by adversary, which is called Jacob's trouble. And as we can see also at the end of the millennium, there will be another attempt just like that to destroy the people of God. Well, you can see in all of these, the Lord's getting ready. Everything will be ready at that time. And the matter will be allowed to go far enough to show just what the adversary intended, the diabolical cruelty and the influence of it. And then the matter will be stopped, and deliverance will come. And so the Lord, we can be assured in each of our cases that we are not only have a guardian angel, but that the Lord is surrounding us with his watchful care, and that when any situation comes, rest assured that the Lord not only knows that it's there, but he knew beforehand, and that he has preparations ready to deliver you out of that if you'll just be faithful to the Lord. See, the one thing that the scriptures tell us the Lord is doing now is to develop the church. He said, "I will give nations for thee. I will give peoples for thee." And so the church is the main thing that the Lord is developing now. And we can rest assured when a situation or trouble faces it, the Lord knows, and he'll give us the strength and deliver us at the proper time. It helps us to trust the Lord, to know that he knows, and to become familiar with the Lord's ways, and to recognize that a part of our suffering is to endure patiently the things that are allowed to happen, and recognize that the Lord will be with us in the adversity. Thank you.
Come midway in our convention. I would like to make an announcement before we close with a hymn. The last